My topic today is Jesus' concept of happiness, and we must begin with the dullest and most necessary preliminary, defining our term. Nearly everyone, from Aristotle to Freud, agrees that we all seek happiness, and that we seek it as an end, not as a means. No one seeks happiness for any other reason. We argue about other things, but not about happiness. We may say, what good are riches if they don't make you happy? But we don't say, what good is happiness if it doesn't make you rich? This is clear to both ancients like Aristotle and moderns like Freud. But there is a very significant difference between the typically ancient and the typically modern meaning of happiness. Ancient words for happiness, like eudaimonia or makarios in Greek, or beatitudo in Latin, mean true, real blessedness, while the modern English word happiness usually means merely subjective satisfaction or contentment, so that in modern English, if you feel happy, you're happy. It makes no sense in modern English to tell someone you think you're happy, but you're not. But that is precisely the main point of the most famous book in the history of philosophy, Plato's Republic, that justice, the all-inclusive virtue, is always profitable, that is, happifying, and injustice never is. Thus, that the just man, even if, like Socrates, he has nothing else, is happy. And the unjust man is not, even if he has everything else, like Gyges or Gollum with his ring of power and invisibility. Thus, we should distinguish the ancient concept, which is really blessedness, from the modern, which is really contentment. I shall be talking about blessedness here. Blessedness differs from contentment in four ways, all of which can be seen by analyzing the Greek word eudaimonia. First, it begins with the prefix eu, meaning good, thus implying that you have to be good, morally good, to be happy. Second, daimon means spirit, thus implying that happiness is a matter of the soul, not the body, and its external goods of fortune. The word happiness, by contrast, comes from the Old English word hap, meaning precisely fortune, luck, or chance, which was the one pagan thought category Christianity subtracted. In all other cases, Christianity added to paganism. As Chesterton said, summing up all spiritual history in three sentences, paganism was the biggest thing in the world, Christianity was bigger, and everything since has been comparatively small. If blessedness is spiritual, it is free. You are responsible for your eudaimonia, but happiness just happens. Third, eudaimonia ends in ia, which means a lasting state, something permanent. Contentment is for the moment, blessedness for a lifetime, so much so that Aristotle, in the Nicomachean Ethics, could not make up his mind whether to agree or disagree with the saying, call no man happy till he is dead. That is, wait for the end of the story to judge it. Fourth, and most important of all, the state of eudaimonia is objective, whereas contentment is subjective. When we say happiness, we usually confuse these two meanings, the ancient and the modern. And that is not wholly unwise, because within the ancient concept of happiness, in a secondary way, there is also present the modern one, the need for some contentment, peace of mind, pleasure, and at least a modicum of the gifts of fortune. While within the modern concept of happiness, that is, within subjective contentment, there is also present, in a secondary way, the feeling for the need of something of the typically ancient ingredient, the need for at least some virtue, and the feeling that the happiness, to be deep and lasting, ought to be real and earned, and true happiness, whatever that may be. We are about to explore Christ's concept of happiness. It is typically ancient, blessedness, but it also includes the above ambiguity, or doubleness of meaning, subjective satisfaction, as well as objective perfection. Let's look first at our concept of happiness. When I speak of our concept, who is us? I mean our culture, the mental landscape we all inhabit, even when we feel like aliens here. Most generally, the modern post-Christian West, but most specifically contemporary America, as it would appear on opinion polls, If an opinion poll were to ask Americans to list the 9 most important ingredients in the happy life, they would probably give an answer pretty much like the following. First, the most obvious, though not the profoundest, ingredient is probably wealth. If you notice your friend has a big smile on his face today, you most likely would say to him, "What happened to you? Did you just win the lottery?" If that's what you'd say, it must be because that's what would put the biggest smile on your face. And let's face it, money can buy everything money can buy, which is a lot of stuff. Second might be our culture's most notable success, the conquest of nature and fortune by science and technology, allowing each of us to be an Alexander the Great, conqueror of the world. Third would probably be freedom from pain. I think few of us would disagree that the single most valuable invention in the entire history of technology has been anesthetics. Fourth would probably be self-esteem. The greatest good, according to nearly all of our culture's new class of prophets, the secular psychologists. And secular psychologists are among the most secular of all classes in our society. Fifth might be justice, securing one's rights. Justice and peace summarize the social ideals of most Americans, the ideals they want for themselves and for the rest of the world. Sixth, if we are candid, we have to include sex. To most Americans, this is the closest thing to heaven on earth, that is, ecstasy, mystical transcending of the ego, unless they're surfers. Seventh, we love to win, whether at war, at sports, at games of chance, in business, or even in our fantasies. Our positive self-esteem requires the belief that we are winners, not losers. We want to be successful, not failures. Eighth, we want honor. We want to be honored, accepted, loved, understood. In our modern egalitarian society, we are honored not for being superior, but for being one of the crowd. In most ancient societies, one was honored for being different, better, superior, excellent. But we still crave to be honored. Some even want to be famous. All want to be accepted. Ninth, we want life, a long life and a healthy life. Thomas Hobbes is surely right in saying that fear of violent death, especially painful and early death, is very, very powerful. Your life is not happy if it is taken from you, obviously. This all seems so obvious and so reasonable as to be beyond argument. Higher ideals than these are arguable. Some of us seek them and some of us do not. But these 9 would seem to be firm and impregnable, universal and necessary. Whoever would deny that they form a part of happiness would be a fool. Whoever would affirm that happiness consisted in their opposites would be insane. Let us now perform a fantastic thought experiment. Let us suppose that there was once a preacher who did teach precisely that insanity, point for point, deliberately and specifically. Perhaps you cannot stretch your imagination quite that far, but I'm going to ask you to stretch it even one step farther. Imagine this man becoming the most famous, beloved, revered, respected, and believed teacher in the history of the world. Imagine nearly everyone in the world, even those who did not classify themselves as his disciples, at least praising his wisdom, especially his moral wisdom, especially the single most famous and beloved sermon he ever preached, the Sermon on the Mount, the summary of his moral wisdom, which begins with his 180-degree reversal of these truisms. Perhaps you find this far too incredible to be imaginable. It would be a miracle harder to believe than God becoming a man. It is hard enough to believe that anyone would believe the strange Christian notion that a certain man who began his life as a baby, who had to learn to talk, and ended it as an executed criminal who bled to death on a cross, and in between got tired and hungry and sorrowful, is God, eternal, beginningless, immortal, infinitely perfect, all-wise, all-powerful, the Creator? But it is even harder to believe that anyone would believe his utterly shattering paradoxes about happiness. Perhaps we do not really believe them after all. Perhaps we only believe we believe them. Perhaps we have faith in our faith rather than faith in his teachings. For, of course, I am referring to Christ's eight Beatitudes, which open his Sermon on the Mount, the most famous sermon ever preached, and the one part of the New Testament that is still held up as central and valid and true and good and beautiful, even by dissenters, heretics, revisionists, demythologizers, skeptics, modernists, theological liberals, and anyone else who cannot bring himself to believe all the other claims of the New Testament or the teachings of the Church. These people strain at the gnats but swallow the camel. So let's look at the camel that they swallow. Perhaps they only seem to swallow it. Perhaps they swallow only their own swallowing, galloping like Gollum. To our desire for wealth, Christ says, blessed are the poor in spirit. To our desire for painlessness, he says, blessed are those who mourn. To our desire for conquest, he says, blessed are the meek. To our desire for contentment with ourselves, he says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. To our desire for justice, he says, blessed are the merciful. To our desire for sex, he says, blessed are the pure in heart. To our desire for conquest, he says, blessed are the peacemakers. To our desire for acceptance, he says, blessed are the persecuted. And to our desire for more life, he offers the cross. And now this man, carrying his cross to Calvary, even dares to tell us, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. We say how blessed we are as individuals or as a nation when we have wealth. He says, no, you are blessed when you are poor. Poor not only in your bank account, but even more than that, not less, poor down to the depths of your heart, poor in spirit, detached from riches, whether you are physically rich or poor. When Harvard University invited Mother Teresa to give a commencement address, she shocked them by taking issue with the gracious invitation they sent to her as the most famous person in one of the world's poorest nations to address the world's richest nation. She said, no, India is not a poor nation. India is a very rich nation. She has a wealth of riches, true spiritual riches. And America is not a rich nation. She is a poor nation, in fact, a desperately poor nation. She slaughters her own unborn children. And why? Because the mother fears those children will be poor, or will make her poor. The mother fears that she will not be able to afford to have these children, as if children are like cars or computers, calculable items in the household's economy, consumer goods rather than consumers, objects rather than subjects, part of the circle rather than the center of the circle. The supposed insanity of Christ's saying thus turns out to be an illusion of perspective. In a lunatic asylum, from the lunatic's point of view, it is the sane outsider who is insane. How useful to have a continual supply of outsiders, the saints, to remind us of where we live, east of Eden, in a lunatic asylum. Christ gives us a map to show how far east of Eden we are. The poor in spirit, of course, are not the weak-spirited. They are exactly the opposite. They are strong enough to be detached from riches, that is, from the whole world. They are those who are strong enough not to be enslaved to their desires for the things of this world. Well, what could Christ possibly mean by his second beatitude? Weeping and mourning is certainly not an expression of contentment, of the painless state that we all long for as part of happiness. Yet Christ tells us that those who mourn are blessed. How ridiculous for some Bible translations to translate Makarios by happy in this verse. In a society that means by happy, simply subjectively satisfied or content. That translation would make Christ say, those who weep are content. Which is not a meaningful paradox, but a meaningless self-contradiction. Mourning is the expression of inner discontent, of the gap between desire and satisfaction, that is, of suffering. Buddha founded an entire religion on the problem of suffering, or dukkha, and its cause, tanha, or greed, and its cure, the Noble Eightfold Path leading to nirvana, the abolition of both suffering and its source. Unlike Buddha, Christ came not to free us from suffering, but to transform its meaning, to make it salvific. He came to save us from sin, and he did so precisely by embracing the suffering and death that are the result of sin. It must sound as absurd to a Buddhist to say that suffering is redemptive as it would sound to a Christian to say that sin is redemptive. Each religion must accuse the other of the most radical practical error, confusing the problem with the solution. The reason Christ gave for declaring mourners blessed is that they shall be comforted. For in hope, this future is made present. It's true that 1 foot up and 1 foot down, that's the way to London town, whether one is going to London to be crowned king or to be hanged on Traitor's Gate. But the future destiny of the journey makes everything in the journey itself different, not just accidentally, but essentially, and not just extrinsically, but intrinsically. A journey to be hanged is tragic, even if it is in a comfortable coach. A journey to be crowned as glorious, even if it is in an uncomfortable wagon, is glorious. St. Teresa said, looked at from the viewpoint of heaven, the most horribly painful earthly life will turn out to be no more than one night in an inconvenient hotel. And Christ has the viewpoint of heaven. Christ is the viewpoint of heaven. Christ is heaven. In giving us himself, he gives us heaven and its viewpoint, that is his. The meek who will inherit the earth, whom Christ calls blessed, who are they? They are not well known. They do not thirst for honor, fame, or glory, and do not usually have it. We all want to be known, but God, who is supremely blessed, is anonymous. He works by nature most of the time. He's reluctant to perform miracles. He hides instead of constantly showing his glory. He came as a baby and died as an executed criminal and lets himself be ignored. He lets himself be eaten daily as what looks like a little piece of bread. He is utterly meek and utterly blessed. If we are utterly meek, we will be utterly blessed. If we are half meek, we will be half blessed. If we are not meek, we will not be blessed. For God is the source of all blessedness, and God is meek, and the effect cannot be the opposite of the cause. The meekness that Christ calls blessed in his third beatitude is indeed in sharp contrast to the desire to conquer nature that Francis Bacon declared to be the new summum bonum, the new meaning of life on earth, and to the desire to conquer fortune that was Machiavelli's new summum bonum. But it is not the contrast that the world thinks. It is not a blessing on wimps, sissies, dish rags, wallflowers, shrinking violets, worrywarts, Uriah Heeps, nebbishes, nerds, or geeks. The meek are those who do not harm, who do not see life as competitive, because they understand the two premises from which this conclusion logically follows. First, that the best things in life are spiritual things, not material things, that life's meaning is to be found in wisdom and love and creativity, in understanding and sanctity and beauty, rather than in money or power or fame or land, or military or athletic conquest. And they understand the second principle, too, that spiritual things are not competitive, that they multiply when shared, while material things are divided when shared. Since happiness depends on understanding the best things in life, and since the best things in life are spiritual, and since spiritual things do not diminish when shared, and since what does not diminish when shared cannot be attained by competition, and since competition is the alternative to meekness, therefore meekness makes for happiness. We should not be surprised that Christ the Logos is at least as logical as Socrates, or that we are not. That's why his pure reason sounds outrageously paradoxical to us. As Chesterton said, it's impossible to stop quoting Chesterton. That's like stopping eating potato chips. It is because we are standing on our heads that Christ's philosophy seems upside down. We are looking at the earth and kicking up in rebellion against the heavens. Christ's fourth beatitude, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, cuts to the rotten flesh at the heart of the modern world. It shows a striking difference between our culture and all others, especially our own culture's past. As Solzhenitsyn said in his great and shocking 1978 Harvard commencement address, nothing more conspicuously distinguishes us than our lack of courage, our lack of passion. You see this strikingly when you live in another culture. or even when you read the writings of another culture, like the Middle Ages, or ancient Israel. Kierkegaard says in Either Or, "Let others complain that our age is wicked. My complaint is that it is wretched, for it lacks passion. Men's thoughts are thin and flimsy like lace. They themselves are pitiable like lace makers. The thoughts of their hearts are too paltry to be sinful. For a worm it might be regarded as a sin to harbor such thoughts, but not for a being made in the image of God. Even their lusts are dull and sluggish, their passions sleepy. They do their duty, these shopkeeping souls, but they clip the coin a trifle. They think that even if the Lord keeps a careful set of books, they may still cheat him a little. Out upon them. This is the reason my soul always turns back to the Old Testament and Shakespeare. Those who speak there are at least human beings. They hate, they love, they murder their enemies and curse their descendants throughout all generations. They sin." The greatest good, according to our culture's primary prophets, is self-esteem, self-satisfaction. Christ shocks us by blessing dissatisfaction. Not the dissatisfaction with our place in the world, not worldly ambition, the profit motive, the American dream, hunger for glory, honor, fame, power, wealth, or success, but hunger and thirst for righteousness, for sanctity. Dissatisfaction with our sins. Passionate thirst for a sanctity we know we do not have and know we must have. There is one thing in the lives of all the saints that turns us off and cuts us off from perhaps the single most effective evangelistic weapon in the church's arsenal, using the lives of the saints. And that is the saints' passionate insistence that they are great sinners, and their insistent passion for holiness. It's not that we do not admire holiness. It's that we do not admire the passion for holiness, the hunger and thirst for righteousness. What Christ blesses, we curse as fanaticism, our soft, sophisticated culture's worst insult. But this is Christ's blessing. More than a blessing, it is a requirement. It is what our Lord requires us to be in order to be his. That is, to be a saint. That is, a fanatic. To love one thing infinitely. To put all our eggs in his basket. It contains only one pearl of great price. He uses a shocking word for our Laodicean niceness. "Because you are neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth." He is content with us only if we are discontent with ourselves. Freud wrote that our civilization's success in seeking contentment has produced instead greater discontent. A profound question, but he did not know the answer why. I think that was the profoundest thing he ever wrote. Only one step from Augustine's great answer, that our hearts are restless until they rest in God. Pascal, on the other hand, knew why. For his patient, unlike Freud's, was himself. And his psychoanalyst, unlike Freud's, was not himself, but Christ. And therefore he knew why we multiply our passions for little things and decrease our passion for great things. Why we multiply diversions and cultivate indifference, especially to death and our eternal destiny. He knew where this disease came from. He wrote, "The fact that there exist men who are indifferent to the loss of their whole being and the peril of an eternity of wretchedness is against nature. With everything else, they are quite different. They fear the most trifling things. They foresee them and feel them. The same man who spends many days and nights in fury and despair at losing some office or some imaginary affront to his honor is the very one who knows that he is going to lose everything through death, but feels neither anxiety nor emotion. It is a monstrous thing to see one and the same heart at once so sensitive to minor things and so strangely insensitive to the greatest. It is an incomprehensible spell, a supernatural torpor that points to a supernatural power as its cause." Many thinkers have written sentences that begin like this: there are only two kinds of people, or there are only three kinds of people. In fact, one version goes like this: there are only two kinds of people, those who believe there are only two kinds of people and those who don't. But Pascal's version is the best I have ever heard. He writes, there are only three kinds of people. Those who seek God and have found him. These are wise and happy. Those who seek God and have not yet found him. These are wise and unhappy. And those who live without either seeking God or finding him. And these are both unwise and unhappy. You see, it is the seeking, the hungering and thirsting that makes all the difference. In fact, the eternal difference. Jesus said it even more succinctly than Pascal. Jesus spoke more succinctly than anyone ever. Seek and you shall find, implying that non-seekers do not find. The Pharisees were non-seekers, like the pop psychologists, full of self-esteem. Therefore, he said to them that he had come on earth to save everyone but them. He said, those who are sick need a physician, not those who are well. I came to call not the righteous, but sinners. Socrates said the same thing on the intellectual level, that there are only two kinds of people, fools who believe they're wise and the wise who believe they're fools. Pascal says there are two kinds of people, sinners who believe they are saints and saints who believe they are sinners. Jesus says that the fools and the saints are right. And the clear empirical test for the difference between them is the hunger and thirst, the passion, the discontent. When Christ says that those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, that is, for sanctity, shall be satisfied, does he mean they shall be satisfied only in the next life? I think he means they will begin to be satisfied even in this one. Already in this life, the saints have a peace and a joy that the world cannot give. They are at the same time dissatisfied and satisfied, like Romeo with Juliet, like yourself listening to a great symphony or watching a great storm at sea. By a wonderful paradox, the refusal to accept self-esteem turns out to be the highest self-esteem. To accept the title sinner means you are the king's kid acting like an ape. To refuse that title and accept yourself as you are means that you are only a clever, successfully evolved ape, even when you act like a prince. What a privilege to sing, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. No ape, however evolved, can rise to the dignity of being a wretch. Only one destined for infinite, unending, and unimaginable ecstasy in spiritual marriage to God can bear the dignity of being a wretch. Only the betrothed is wretched until united with the spouse. Fifth, we want our rights. That's why if we are moral, we work for justice, for others' rights. We are practicing the golden rule, the categorical imperative. This is justice. Christ does not condemn it, but he does not call this blessed, because that is only a minimum, not a maximum. That is only the beginning, not the end, the foundation, not the house. It is not enough. Justice alone cannot ensure peace in the world, in the family, or in friendships. Only mercy can. Our hope should not be that we will get justice. My goodness, what would become of us if we did? Our hope is under the mercy. It was mercy that created us. How could we justly deserve the gift of existence if we didn't even exist? It was mercy that redeemed us from the justice that we deserved by our sins. And it is mercy that will gratuitously and graciously raise us higher than the angels in uniting us with the divine nature. Christ did not become an angel, and no angel will ever become hypostatically united with God. We are told by one who always meant exactly what he said that it is more blessed to give than to receive. The mere act of giving necessarily is best, including the act of giving mercy. We do not give mercy in order to obtain mercy. That is justice, not mercy. We give mercy in order that the other may get mercy. And only thus, only by giving without the intention of getting mercy, do we get mercy. Not from the human we give it to, but from God, who started this chain of mercy givers by the mercy of creation and ends it with the mercy of redemption and glorification. The book of Revelation should not be called the last judgment, but the last mercy. It ends there. Let him who wills come and take the water of life without price. That's the gospel. Sixth, when we hear the word purity in the Beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, we immediately think of sexual purity. Perhaps Christ had that primarily in mind, perhaps not. But our reaction tells us something significant about us, namely, that sex is quite simply our society's new god, our new absolute. Anything is done, tolerated, sacrificed, justified, sanctified, or glorified for this god. A third of our mothers murder their own unborn babies in sacrifice to this god. Of course abortion is about sex. The only reason for abortion is to have sex without babies. Abortion is backup contraception. Or look at the acceptance of divorce. Families, the one absolutely necessary building block of all societies, are destroyed for this god. Half of Americans' citizens commit suicide for this god. For divorce is the suicide of the one flesh that love had created. No one justifies lying, cheating, betraying, promise-breaking, devastating and harming strangers, but we justify, we expect, we tolerate doing this to the one person we promise most seriously to be faithful to forever. We justify divorce. No one justifies child abuse, except for sex. Divorce is child abuse for the sake of sex. Even all the churches justify divorce, except one. The one that does not claim the authority to correct Christ. And she is accused of being authoritarian. Why is purity of heart blessed? Doesn't seem to be. Well, because lust gives such an immediate thrill of delight, Christ's beatitude that blesses purity of heart, that is, purity of desire, strikes us as a paradox. But anything that is natural is happier and more blessed in its pure and natural condition. St. Thomas Aquinas deduces from this principle that sexual pleasure was far greater before the fall. When Christ specifies the reward as seeing God, he does not mean merely in the next life. He does not mean merely that we will get box seats instead of bleachers in heaven's stadium as a just reward for paying more for the tickets here on earth. The reward can be experienced in this life. St. Thomas himself exemplified it. His wonderful clarity of mind came partly from his purity of heart, a gift which was supernaturally given to him at one specific point in his life, when he resisted his brother's attempt to seduce him out of the Dominican order by a prostitute, so that his mind would be free from his passions, free for the high vocation God planned for him. Most modern readers are very surprised to find all the great doctors of the Church, including St. Augustine, St. Thomas, and St. John of the Cross, locating the chief harm of lust in its blinding of the reason, the remarkable narrowing and skewering of vision, of perspective. Surely there is an intimate connection between the impurity of the desires of most modern students and the impurity of their motivation for education. Between the decline of the sexual love of the other for the other and of the intellectual love of the truth for the truth. A connection between the contemplative wonder and respect towards the mind's mate, truth, and the contemplative wonder and respect towards the body's mate. To love truth primarily for itself is one thing. To love it primarily for your own sake, for some further utilitarian, instrumental, pragmatic, personal end, is another thing. That is a form of impurity of heart, a sort of intellectual prostitution. And it has cursed modern philosophy ever since Bacon. The blessing Christ promises here is verifiable in this life, in experience, though perfected only in the next. How many theologians fail to see God, to understand purely, because of impure desires? Almost all theological dissent in our age, dissent, we used to call it heresy, astonishingly focuses on sexual morality. It looks suspiciously like addicts obsessing about their drug and not really caring about much else. Is that why most homilies are so bland and why we never hear a homily on sexual morality, even though that is the single most controversial and divisive issue in our church and in our culture today? Could it be that the reason we lack the blessing of understanding God and that our children suffer an incredible absence of basic theological education is because the educators, the writers of those stunningly dull CCD and RCIA textbooks, have not the pure desire for truth that Christ specifies as the virtue that draws to itself that reward? If we analyze the blood their heart pumps into their brains, might we find it mixed with fluids from lower organs? Could it be that our liturgical language, and especially our liturgical music, is so fascinatingly dull and brilliantly dumbed down and passionately wimpy is because the liturgist's passions are disordered? Seventh, Christ blesses not peace, but peacemakers. Peacemakers are not pacifists. Peacemakers are warriors, but they are spiritual warriors, warriors against war. Sometimes war can be conquered only by war. Everyone speaks highly of peacemaking. How then is that countercultural, except to terrorists? Because the peace that Christ blesses is the peace the world cannot give, not the peace it can give. It is peace with neighbor, self, and God, not with the world, the flesh, and the devil. It is not peace with greed, lust, and pride, but the peace that comes through poverty, chastity, and obedience. Three most countercultural virtues. These two kinds of peace are, in fact, at war with each other. Our world's peacemakers will embrace Christ's peace, but only if they do not have to give up the world's peace, only if they do not have to fight for it. Thus, paradoxically, we lack true peace because we are reluctant to war against the enemies of peace. And also because we do not put the three ingredients of Christ's peace in the proper order. We preach incessantly about peace with neighbor, but seldom about peace with God. Thomas Merton reminds us of this necessary order in three wonderfully simple sentences when he says, "We are not at peace with each other because we are not at peace with ourselves, and we are not at peace with ourselves because we are not at peace with God." Christ does the same in putting the first table of the law first, as Moses did. We need to relearn lesson one. Christ blesses peacemakers, but when you are at war, you can make peace only by waging and winning a war. Christianity is judgmental and repressive and negative, for Christianity says to us that we are at war, ever since a certain incident in Eden, and war judges the enemy. That's why a war is fought, because a judgment is made about an enemy, and represses the enemy. That is what defense is, repressing the enemy's offense, and negates the enemy, destroys the enemy. That is what offense is, destroying the enemy's defense. Our enemies are real, just as real as flesh and blood. They are principalities and powers. They are not men, they are demons. And they are also our own sins. Our Lord told us that he came into the world to bring a sword, to wage and win this war. The sword is a cross. Happiness does not consist in pacifism. Happiness consists in peace. And peace can be attained only by waging and winning a war to make peace. The cross is like a syringe. It gives us a blood transfusion. It is the opposite of a normal sword. What Christ does is exactly the opposite of what Dracula does. Dracula, like the demons, takes our blood, our life. Christ gives us a blood transfusion. We are on a battlefield between Christ and Dracula. When Christ says that peacemakers are blessed because they will be called the sons of God, he does not mean that peacemaking is the cause and being a son of God is an effect. The other way round, only the sons of God can make God's peace, do God's work. Peacemaking is the effect. But peacemakers are called sons of God. They're known to be sons of God because we recognize the cause by the effect. The eighth beatitude blesses not just pain or suffering, but persecution. That is, suffering imposed by rejection and hatred. This is the only one of the beatitudes that Christ repeats, both to emphasize it as the final, most outrageous beatitude of all, and to emphasize that it is not merely the pain, but the rejection, the reviling, the slander that is blessed. But how can this be? Everyone wants to be loved. How can it be blessed to be hated? One possible explanation is utterly inconsistent with Christ, a kind of sneering superiority, as if it were blessed to say to those who hate us, "I wouldn't want love from worthless fools like you." Surely it is great grief that the persecutors are fools. Of course, they're not worthless fools. If there were, there would be no reason for our grief for them. And therefore, grief on our part that they are not blessed is real if we love our persecutors, as Christ does and commands us to. Love your enemies. Notice he does not say, do not use the word enemy. It is not nice. We have enemies, but we must love them. The reward that makes persecution blessed is the same as the one that makes poverty blessed, the kingdom of heaven. Persecution has the same blessing as poverty, because persecution is a form of poverty. Poverty not of money, but of love, that is, of being loved. Both money and love are blessed only when they are given, and it is more blessed to give than to receive. We desperately crave love from the world, but the world is not Christ. The world is fallen into the knowledge of good and evil. The world is therefore afraid of Christ as the cavity is afraid of the dentist, or as the liar is afraid of the light. I use the word world here in the scriptural sense, not as the planet, Gaia, matter, which God created good, but as the time word, eon, that designates the era of sin, the kingdom of the devil. Persecution is not blessed in itself, but it becomes blessed if it is persecution for righteousness' sake, for the sake of God. Not only explicitly, but also implicitly. That is, if you are persecuted for being that which God is, for being godlike, for being righteous. Thus the righteous pagan, like Socrates, is also blessed when he is misunderstood, hated, rejected, persecuted, and killed, like Christ. Just as your peacemaking is a sign that you are a child of God and thus blessed, so being persecuted for the sake of your righteousness is also a sign that you are a member of his kingdom and thus blessed. Blessing comes only from what is good, and persecution, poverty, etc. are not good in themselves. Christ is not a Stoic or a Hindu or a Buddhist. Blessing does not come from not caring about the good things of this world, which God created, nor from seeing through this world as an illusion, as Maya, nor from the clever device of spiritual euthanasia, by which our desires for things are quenched so that we can avoid the suffering that they bring. No, the Christian knows something real and good in itself that the Stoic, the Hindu, and the Buddhist do not know, even though they may implicitly long for it, and even attain it in the end, and that something is simply Jesus Christ. He makes blessed even the nails in his cross, and only he makes them blessed. Our ninth desire is for life, and the ninth blessing is death. Death contains all the other paradoxes. Christ teaches us this blessing of death not in words only, but also in deed by his cross, which sums up all the Beatitudes. And the cross reveals the hidden source of all eight Beatitudes, the historical fact, not the abstract principle, that God, out of sheer love for us, became incarnate, died, and rose to save us from sin and death. As Dorothy Sayers said, the dogma is the drama. By this dramatic judo, death itself was turned into an instrument for life. As an earthen dam is overwhelmed by the waters of the flood that conquers it, and the dam is swept along and made into a part of the flood itself. So the flood of God's infinite life, when it entered our world, not only conquered death, but turned death itself into life's most powerful instrument. In the words of an old oratorio, thou hast made death glorious and triumphant, for through its portals we enter into the presence of the living God. We anticipate that final death and its final blessing in all our little deaths now. Our participation in Christ's eight Beatitudes are those little deaths. We not only anticipate it, we actually participate it in these little deaths. The real little or large dyings that we do every day. And we also anticipate and actually participate in the final blessing, the presence of a living God, every time we open our eyes and see who it is that is really present there. Where our eyes see only the most undramatic little wafer of bread, look who is present. How absurd that we find it easier to get up off our knees than to get down. The secret of happiness is very simple. It is Jesus. Not just the philosophy of Jesus, but Jesus, his real presence, He actually comes to us in such unlikely vehicles as poverty, pain, persecution. He has weird taste in vehicles. He came to Jerusalem on a donkey. And when he comes, he acts with power, though usually also with subtlety and not bombast. He really works. I am haunted by my memories of a few precious hours in the company of the two happiest groups of people I have ever met in my life. In both cases, I was supposed to speak to them. In both cases, they spoke to me with very few words, like Mother Teresa, like Jesus. One group was, in fact, Mother Teresa's nuns in Boston's worst slum. Another was a convent of contemplative Carmelites in Danvers, Massachusetts. What they said to me, simply by being who they were, was unmistakable. See how happy I am. See how happy Jesus makes me. This is how happiness happens. It is not so much taught like math, but caught like measles. The church is in the business of spreading the good infection, like in the invasion of the body snatchers, only this is a good infection. And that is the new evangelism. And it is also the old evangelism that won the world 2,000 years ago. It will do it again, for there is no argument against real happiness. The smiles of the saints are the arguments that will win the world for Christ again. They are unarguable. Only one thing, then, is necessary to create a world of happiness from pole to pole. And it is not doing any of the many good things that Martha did, but doing the one thing that Mary did. Just sit at Jesus' feet. Just be in his presence. Know his love all day. That is the scandalously simple secret of happiness. I thank you for sitting through a long lecture, which was your purgatory. Now you get to the heaven of asking questions. I didn't say anything terribly clever, creative, original, or scholarly. I'm a hobbit. Hobbits like to say things they know over and over again. And I'm sure you know all this, but nevertheless, you will have questions about it. If you do not have any questions, I will have to tell you my favorite anecdote from Lives of the Great Philosophers, where Aristotle once lectured to his university students, and there were no questions afterwards. And he says, my lecture, if you remember, was on levels of intelligence in the universe. According to my philosophy, there are three. There are gods, mortals, and beasts. The way to distinguish mortals from both gods and beasts is that mortals alone ask questions. For beasts know too little, and gods too much. Thus, if you have no questions, shall I congratulate you upon having risen to the status of gods, or shall I insult you upon having sunk to the level of beasts? There were questions. Any mortals among us? Thank you.
Unrelated. Can we expect more articles from you in the National Catholic Register in the future?
I don't know. I've lost contact with them. But if they want some more, maybe I'll turn out some more.
You used to be a regular.
Yeah. I collected some scattered articles in a book called Fundamentals of the Faith, which turned out to be very popular, and that surprised me because the articles were not meant to be complete. They were just scattered. But apparently such a book is sorely needed, so I spent a couple of years writing a more complete one called Catholic Christianity, a commentary on the New Catechism, which I hope will be used in parishes and CCD programs.
Is that in print now?
Yeah, Ignatius Press. It's also obtainable free from the Knights of Columbus.
Rabbi George at Princeton has his counterpart, Peter Singer. Do you have any kind of Peter Singers in your life? And if so, do they espouse any kind of philosophy or answer to the question that Freud raised, which is, why are people so discontented at a time when contentment is the object of living?
No, I just teach at a Jesuit school. I guess I can't improve on that answer. Any other questions? Yes?
What does Jesus mean when he said, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth? didn't explain about the second part.
I think he meant two things. I think the blessings attached to each beatitude begin in this life and are perfected in the next. The way in which the saints inherit the new earth, which according to Scripture will be given to us, is not known to us. I think there is good reason for that. I think if we knew some of the things that awaited us in the next earth, it would pollute our desires and inflame our curiosity. I'm expecting, for instance, a lot of magic. But the way in which the meek inherit the earth, even in this life, was known, I think, even by the great pagan mystic Lao Tzu in the Tao Te Ching. He was very happy through his being meek and through not opposing and not conquering nature, but letting it conquer him. When we want to conquer something and succeed, we're a little happy for a little while, but when we let something bigger than us conquer us, whether it's a truth that we discover in our thinking or reading or research, or whether it's a good that we allow to flow through our lives and improve the world through our agency, or whether it's a beauty which we simply discover and contemplate and are happy in the presence of, we know that something bigger than our soul has entered it and conquered it, and we're very happy. That's why twice in my life, I have had something a little bit like a mystical experience. Once was the first time I ever heard Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I thought, I have ceased to be a human being. I am now the music itself. I will never get back into my body. And the second was when I was body surfing in a hurricane, and I was convinced that I had become the ocean, and the ocean cannot drown in the ocean, therefore I cannot drown in the ocean. They were both, you might say, fearful experiences, but both very wonderful, because something larger than you comes in to live in your house. But if you're not meek, you don't open the door.
What is the beginning of the next life? Is it at the point of that symphony?
Baptism. When the new life enters our souls. It used to be the moment of creation. God created Adam and Eve in a state of at least preternatural, if not supernatural, happiness. They lost that. It has to be restored. We are born into this world deprived of it. That's what original sin means. So Christ plants the seed only when faith and baptism, which are always connected in Scripture, come together. And then it keeps growing. And in the next life, it's transplanted into a heavenly pot.
I think the difference.
Okay.
The next life doesn't begin even after death.
It begins now.
It begins at the point, really, of the presence.
Mm-hmm.
Of Christ entering the person, and the person is aware of God's presence in a way. And, you know, it's really sad, like in the New Testament, there's only two people that really seem to grasp this, John and Paul. Most of the other people, a lot of them, had the presence seen, but they didn't know the distinction because they knew Christ.
Well, you can be pregnant without knowing it, and you can be in the presence of someone without acknowledging it, although it's incomplete. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
So this has been the Church's rationale for infant baptism. Although the infant doesn't know what's going on, the faith of the Church and the faith of the parents so counts for the infant that real presence can happen at baptism.
I think that's a seed. It's the potential for growth. It's the opening of the door.
Yes.
Months later. And with those nuns, they're in their happiness. Bonhoeffer in prison.
Yep.
Is in heaven.
Yep.
Heaven is on earth.
Sure.
The Our Father said.
If it doesn't begin here, it's not going to be perfected there. I agree.
But it's so sad, so few people, and I think even the Beatitudes, are really speaking of the entire extreme journey that is necessary for seeking.
This has always been, it seems to me, as a convert from Protestantism, the genius of Catholic theology, to connect together justification and sanctification, to connect together faith and the life of the works of love. It's one thing. It comes in one end and out the other, so to speak. Comes in through faith and out through the life of love. It's the same life, and it has to begin here.
You mentioned Taoism in terms of tiny pieces, you know, instead of working against the grain, but growing with the flow of things, as you mentioned, in the ocean. In Hinduism and in Buddhism, as I understand it, inner peace is attained by detachment and a relinquishing of desire, as well as imposition of one's will or desire upon anyone else. Our greatest Christian and Catholic mystics write about these same notions. How do you reconcile this this need to this need of the human soul to be able to attain this inner peace accompanied with joy, and yet try to change the world for Christ?
That's a problem only from the outside. As soon as Christ enters into you, that's going to change the world. The question is something like the following. You're in a dark room. You want to read the newspaper. You don't know how to turn the light on. Somebody tells you where the light switch is. Do you have two problems or one? Problem number one, turning the light switch on. Problem number two, reading the newspaper. No. The first problem is all you need to solve. So as soon as Christ enters a life, it becomes active. After Mary sat at the feet of Christ, she probably did the works of Martha much more effectively than Martha ever did. But Christ begins with first things first. He does heart surgery. And then the new heart pumps the new blood into all the capillaries and they become healthy. Because faith is one, works are many. So we start with the one.
So then it's not so much the imposition of our will.
No. No, it's His will. It's His will. This is why I love Muslim mystics. They're wonderfully simple. They lack all sorts of things, but they got the foundation very clear. Islam, perfect submission. Once that happens, Allah, God, is a fire, and He lights up everything. So it's really only one thing you need. Christ Himself says that. There's only one thing necessary. Because that one thing is not inactive. It's not something static. It's not something like a principle, unreal. It's the force that banged out the Big Bang with no effort. That's as active as it could be. So ultimately, there's no disconnect between contemplation and action. Yes?
This is not a terribly deep question, but I wanted to know if you could explain. There's lots of examples in our culture of justice, but I don't see very many examples in our culture of mercy. And I'm wondering if you could help illustrate it there.
Well, I first of all have to admit that to translate Christ's words, especially about justice and mercy, into social, political, and public terms is much harder than to practice them in one's individual life. And that there has to be something of a double standard. You can't expect a society to be a saint, but you can expect an individual to be a saint. So I don't think the law should mandate being a saint. It may mandate being a good Samaritan, but there's a minimum and a maximum. But on the other hand, I think you do see examples of that. The thing that springs to mind immediately is the Marshall Plan. Once we had defeated Germany, what did we do? We raised her up off her knees instead of stomping on her. So if we go into Iraq, and I hope we don't have to, I hope it will be with the minimum of surgery and the maximum of nursing care.
Probably not a question, but how do you reconcile or talk a little bit about the idea of happiness coming from doing for others as opposed to, if it is opposed to, living within?
I don't think there's any argument that will convince someone who doesn't understand it, except try it, you'll see. It works. What puzzles me is all of us have done two experiments in our lives. We've tried selfishness and we've tried charity. And we've always gotten the same results. Selfishness hasn't made us happy and charity has. Why do we keep doing the failed experiment over and over again? We're nuts. But I think you need to do a little more than appeal to the person's own experience. When were you the happiest? Wasn't it when you forgot yourself the most? I think we all know that. Not from reason, but from experience.
Doesn't Christ ask us to look within, too, though?
Well, he says, well, where in particular? Occasionally, but I think not as much as we ordinarily think. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that we look within a lot too much, especially when we want to be judges and when we want to evaluate. When I look at myself with an evaluative mind, except for necessarily brief moments before confession, I say either, what a nice boy am I, and I become a self-righteous Pharisee, or what a terribly bad boy am I, and I become a guilt-ridden worm, or, well, I'm sort of in the middle, and then I become a dull, wishy-washy Charlie Brown. So I think the solution is to think about ourselves a lot less. The eye is meant to look outwards, not inward. Occasionally it needs a mirror, especially when there's something wrong with it. But I'm not one on a lot of self-analysis. I don't find that it gets me very far. Maybe that's just a quirk of personality. I wouldn't want to dogmatize.
I'm getting lost a little bit. Could you define happiness again? It's not contentment, is that right?
Some things are hard to define. I can't define it by genus and specific difference, I don't think. But what I mean by happiness is a state of life in which you are truly blessed. That is, that which is good for you, that which you were designed for, is present, and you know that it is present, and you feel it present. That would be complete happiness. The most important ingredient is the objective blessedness. And then secondarily, if it's complete, you also know it and feel it. I think our culture is, after the second thing without the first, a kind of psychological masturbation without the real presence of the other.
In light of all you've said about the difference between worldly happiness and true blessedness, what do you have to say to the Psychological Institute? What's the purpose?
You know that better than I. You know whose work you're doing and who's helping you to do it. I came here to learn from you, not vice versa. Just keep doing what you're doing. I'm a cheerleader, not the manager.
In that same vein, you mentioned we live in an insane asylum, or at least one could say that. Mm-hmm. And in the insane asylum, even if you know the attitudes, it's a little hard to put them into action. Mm-hmm. Or if you do, is mm-hmm. anybody going to notice? Or are you going to even notice? And I guess I would like to have your reflections on the issue of the status of our culture and the ability of those of us who live in it, as well as those of us who do not, to attain this kind of happiness you're talking about, when you have the wholesale loss of what Western civilization gave to the culture and vice versa. And that is to say, leisure, true leisure, in deeper sense, leisure, the basis of culture, the loss of Western monasticism, as well as Eastern monasticism, which gave a kind of pause, a time out from the madness of the insane asylum. Can you comment on that cultural aspect of happiness?
I think there's four states you can be in relation to your culture. The best state would be in a good and happy culture. You're at peace and you deserve it and you enjoy it. The worst state would be you have been defeated and there is no hope. There are two states between those two, going up and going down. Going down from a peaceful, wise, and happy and successful culture into decline and trying to hold the culture together against this decline. That's a rather unhappy state. That's a state of fighting defensive wars against the barbarians outside the gates who are coming in. I think we're in none of those three positions. I think we're in a fourth position. I think we are now the barbarians outside the gates. I think the culture has declined to a point where, for all practical purposes, our public culture is pagan, is non-Christian. So being an adolescent who never grew up, I welcome the opportunity to be the bad guys on the attack, the rebels. We're Ho Chi Minh. We're not South Vietnam, and we're going to win. We're moving up.
I just want to make a comment on that previous question about the Institute for Psychological Sciences. A lot of us are not free, bound by obsessions, compulsions, depression, anxiety. And the role of the Institute is to to know God, to love God, to love others, but most importantly, to let this fantastic God that makes the thing bad with no effort really act within ourselves. That's the mission of ACT, to free people to accept God. Thanks.
Touché.
I'd like to thank you for writing this book for teenagers and others. And I wonder if you would sign it for my grandson.
Oh, sure. I'll sign a lot of books later. There's going to be a book signing. I never understood why people want signatures on books, but if that's what you like, fine. Blood now, that I'd understand. Give me a little bit of your blood here. But ink, that's...